You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Ever-living God, whose will it is that all should come to know you through your Son, Jesus Christ, inspire our witness to him, that all may know the power of his forgiveness and the hope of his resurrection, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. We certainly want all people to come to a knowledge of him, and that is part of why we exist as the people of God, right? You know, always welcoming in the stranger, inviting people to consider the claims of Christianity, because they're obviously of eternal importance. I just want to start with, I remember being, I was at the University of Florida prior to this at a mission, mission church to the campus. And, I learned a lot being on a university campus, and interacting with the faculty, grad students, undergrads. I learned a lot. And I remember during the pandemic, as the pandemic went on, there was this sense, even in talking to the professors, about how hollowed out the students felt. Like there was this performative aspect to, they knew what they were supposed to do, but they weren't very like engaged in what they were doing. There's just almost the cynicism of like, let me get through this and get out of this. It was really hard. Perhaps you remember that time. Really hard to be in your body, being present in one place at one time, when there's so many different wheels spinning about what should I be doing, what could I be doing, where am I going to be productive next? And I remember having a number of conversations with really high-end achieving students about this question, like, isn't there more to life? Like, is this it? Being productive, hitting all the measurables, hitting all the goals. And I think in our American society, I think we could all probably identify with that sense of a frenetic, constant being on the treadmill of success and performance, in the midst of also the amount of distraction and busyness that we have to kind of carry with us each week. And so that's why I'm using this term, disenchanted, because I think there is a little bit of a cynicism about things that are spiritual in nature. And so I want to use these terms, and I'm largely borrowing these from a philosopher named Charles Taylor. He's a Canadian who's kind of written on the Western tradition and what has kind of essentially happened in Western Europe and now in North America as it regards a once very very engaged Christian culture that's been the dominant culture, and how we've really moved from this enchanted culture into a more disenchanted one. So I just want to lay out a few terms if this is helpful. And again, this isn't necessarily agreed upon by everybody, but this is a good starting point. So this is one way to talk about what it looks like to hold forth the faith in a very very disenchanted time. So Charles Taylor talks about this enchanted culture being like individuals are porous, right? Like we have this porous sense of things will leave us and come into us, and it's not there's not this strong hard boundary. And so he talks about this recognition of an acceptance of expectations of immediate as well as broadly held practices. Not necessarily a lot of pushback or challenge to what is inherited from before, because it's like, well, this is just how things are. This is how we understand the world. And so there's definitely an openness to possibility beyond what's materially known and understood. And so therefore people, and we tend to think about this as like more of like medieval, right? Or Middle Ages kind of dynamic, pre-scientific, pre-enlightenment, where people are vulnerable to things like cosmic forces and thinking about spiritual dynamics that are at play that aren't always seen. But what we are in, Charles Taylor argues, is a disenchanted culture, which has this, instead of a porous self, there's this buffered self idea that we actually have the ability psychologically to step back and be an outside observer of sorts in our environment, whereby he uses the term expressive individualism, that we will choose to engage or disengage. We can like probe things and think about things and almost think about myself apart from the environment I'm in, which somebody in an enchanted culture would say that's actually not possible to do because you're always part of an environment, right? You can never actually be objective about something. And so because of this, the buffered self in a disenchanted culture, there's this choice. You're always given choices of how to assign your own identity or boundary, regardless of what you've inherited. And so this is, you know, you maybe have heard there's been a lot of ink spilled on people doing, you know, this kind of deconstruction of their faith, right? People are deconstructing. You know, I'd talk to students about that, how they would say, well, I'm deconstructing right now. It's kind of become like a verb. And so anyway, so you're kind of in this age, and this is the post-Enlightenment world we live in, where we're invulnerable. We have this ability to master material and assign meaning to it, okay? So with that, all right. So what Charles Taylor says is that the rationality of our scientific and overly scientific in many ways worldview in the Western world, it's come to kind of dominate how people live day to day. And so in the absence of official religion, what we really have in our culture of individualism is this pursuit of happiness, right? And it's often an individualistic pursuit. And so we're chasing something, right? We're with Kate Bush, we're running up that hill, right? Trying to get close to God or close to whatever we perceive as the good, the true, the beautiful. And so there's this, we are the new authority, right? The authority doesn't come down and kind of give us this vision, but we actually create our own vision. We build it. And so there's this sort of a la carte kind of dynamic. I would talk to students about what does it mean to be spiritual? What does it mean to be religious? Because I was really fascinated by how they experienced those terms. You know, because I heard a lot of people say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. In other words, not affiliated with any actual traditional doctrine, but kind of a hodgepodge, a cornucopia of, well, I pick and choose from different traditions because I'm, at the end, the authority, right? Like, and that's the bounded self whereby I can create a sense of what I accept or don't accept based on what my perception is of the world. And so in this context, in a sense, everything's religious and nothing's religious, right? People get really into politics and that becomes a new kind of fanatical, zealot kind of driven thing, right? So some people have no, like, they wouldn't say they're even religious, but they're really into politics, right? They spend every moment waking and even sleeping, thinking about and dreaming about and plotting about politics or cultural values. Some people are like really into, you know, Iron Tribe or fitness, right? And they're just like, it's like that's their people, that's what they do, and everything kind of comes out of that. So there's a lot of choice that comes from this. But we're all climbing something. We're looking for that pursuit of happiness. And I like this meme. I don't know if you've seen this, but this is me pursuing happiness. This is my experience. I don't know if you can relate to that at all, but, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm climbing up there. I'm going to get there. This is me as an autonomous individual. And, you know, I'm just supposed to ride this stairway to success and happiness and fulfillment. And I'm just tumbling over myself. So in other words, for Charles Taylor, the plausibility structures of an enchanted versus a disenchanted age they're exclusively different, because a disenchanted culture knows that only sensory reliable measurements can give an accurate depiction of reality. right? If it can't be measured and made a data point, right, put it into the computer and it's ones and zeros, then it's real. Or things like science says, right? It's according to science, blank, blank, blank. That's how we know what is true in our culture. Even things like politics, it's political science. There's a science to politics, right? And so anything else, you know, in other words, we should be a little skeptical or suspicious of. So like there's certain things we know, and then there's some things that, well, you need to be skeptical of that. I don't know about that. And so prior to the Enlightenment, the credo was, I believe in order to understand. This is what most humans in most contexts would have said. Well, I'm given a base set of presuppositions that I'm living out of because I'm in a bounded, like I'm living in a environment and culture. They believe things and then they're searching and seeking to understand. But what the Enlightenment did is kind of reverse that, right? I understand in order to believe. Belief, in other words, isn't a prerequisite. It's something that once I can place my foot here, then I know it's real and true. Once I've gotten into a laboratory where it's a very sterile environment, right, I've been able to study it, and now I know it's real, or now I know it's right, or because the math works a certain way. Now that's what's most real. And so what that's done is just changed how we experience life as humans in a lot of ways. So James K. A. Smith is an author, he's a speaker and a philosopher at Calvin College. And he talks about the difference between thick and thin practices. And we all have these, thick and thin practices. Thin practices are things that we do all the time, and they're regular part of our life, but we don't attribute much meaning to them, and we don't derive much meaning from them. So things like brushing your teeth, or the route you take to work or something like that. Those are things that are practices. They're part of your life, but they don't actually like inform who you are or how you inhabit the world in a meaningful way. Another example with this, though, would be like who sleeps with their phone right next to their bed? Yeah, like that would be a thick practice, actually. It's not, we don't imbue it with spiritual significance, but it's actually doing a formation of us. Because then we're like reachable, even when we're like supposed to be in our most restful state, right? That like, I mean, of course, you can turn your, you know, notifications off and things like that, or put in sleep mode. But I mean, I use mine as my alarm, right? But that's actually a thick practice. Or like waking up and checking the, you know, the Twitter feed or the X feed, whatever that's called now, or the news or something, right? That's actually like that creates habits that James K. A. Smith would say are thick habits. They're every bit as religious, in other words, as what we would call like devotional life or spiritual engagement or prayer, because they actually have a profound impact on how we view the world. And the reason I'm saying that is because it makes me ask the question, are we consumers of, or like, are we just getting experiences from living in this world, or are we image bearers who are engaged in an activity in this world? And so what I would say is that we are actually meaning-making creatures because we live as God's image bearers. And I thought of two examples, the influx of zombie films in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, as well as, I don't know if you remember Castaway with Wilson the volleyball, you know? Even in a time or an experience as a castaway on this island, Tom Hanks, he attributed meaning to this relationship with this volleyball because it was some reminder of his humanity, right? Like he created meaning in a very horrific situation. Excuse me. And then these zombie movies are like apocalyptic kind of, what would you do if everything kind of went to pot and the world's on fire and like humanity is about to be erased? Sorry, I'm getting something in the back of my throat. It's kind of stripping down all these ancillary distractions to what is it? I think they're asking the kinds of questions. What does it mean to be human? How do we live a human life in this world? stripped apart from maybe our comforts. And so we are very much shaped in our priorities by our context and our environment. Even in a disenchanted age, we're actually, that's just part of what's hardwired into our DNA, right? We're trying to ascribe meaning, to find something to put meaning, to make sense of our world. And so what's happened in the post-Enlightenment world is this like division between the sacred and secular, right? Almost like an upstairs-downstairs paradigm of Platonic dyad. There's a bifurcation that's come about. And usually it's apart from God. No longer when we separate church and state, for instance, we're kind of saying we don't need God, right? That stays in one realm. Right, there's this realm that we kind of call spiritual or godly, you know, God-related. That's the religious realm. But real life, the stuff that everybody kind of agrees on, is the secular world. And so the plausibility is governed by science and our personal experience. And science actually is intuitive to us. Right, it's like, oh, I see how this works out scientifically. It's been proven from a hypothesis and studied, and so that actually feels more real. And the reason I'm saying all these things is because it has a profound impact, actually, on our brains and as we develop, because we're all asking questions all the time. Maybe we're asking, "Where did I come from? What is all this about?" Maybe we're kind of pitting or maybe we grew up hearing certain things about what the Bible teaches or about what our religious tradition holds. And then sometimes we get these ideas that somehow science is somehow pitted against the religious structure that we grew up with. Right or not, true or not, oftentimes that comes into play. And so what Charles Taylor says is that we've exchanged a transcendent frame of reference for an immanent one, with expressive individualism. And so instead of this, like, you know, bigger picture, glorious kind of depiction, where, you know, it's kind of like me and God and my Bible with my cup of coffee, you know, posting the Instagram picture of I'm just having really important quiet time with God, which of course is good. But we've, as a culture and as people, we've lost a sense of this transcendent, Charles Taylor says. And so our biggest aspect of expressive individualism is this place of meeting of our desire and preference. And so that's like where we get this idea of authenticity. We're really into being authentic. And I call that the McDonaldization of Christianity, even, right? Where it's this franchise spirituality, where I can kind of pick on the menu of what number I like. I like this kind of worship, or I like that kind of expression of Christianity. And it kind of, it's the Burger King have it your way kind of thing. Or how can I fit God into my busy life? And so instead of it being like the plausibility structure as I live under God's canopy, we tend to fit. It sneaks in as something we're fitting in. And so all this to say, in a disenchanted age, when spirituality or church stuff doesn't work anymore, however we define that works for me, they find it really hard to believe when somebody has experiences that don't match up with what they were taught. And many people, many of us, have had experiences that don't match up with the way things should be. And we're always living in that gap between the way it should be and the way it actually is. And that's part of what's really hard, isn't it? About believing God and following Christ in our fallen world. Right, and that's explained in the Christian meta-narrative. And yet, we value experience and individual experience and choice so highly that becomes like the barometer for is this real or not. Does that make sense? I'm going to stop for a second. Any questions or points of reference or connections that would be helpful right here? Which one?
The last part.
Oh, about the gap between the way things ought to be and the way they are?
Yeah.
That? Yeah. I mean, that's what our lived experience often doesn't always deliver what the promises that are made for, like, you know, kind of like the Joel Osteen, that's an easy one to pick on, right? Your best life now, right? Or if you follow Jesus, certain things are going to happen. You're going to feel God's closeness, for instance, right? I talk to a lot of young people who maybe had a camp experience or a conversion experience or like a really warm, wonderful experience growing up in church. And sometimes that starts to feel distant, right? And you get this like almost saran wrap film between your lived experience now and what happened at a previous point in your story. And I think we all have a hard time sometimes reconciling those things. Like, what? It's not just, oh, I'm going through a season where I'm having trouble experiencing God. I've talked to a number of people who, I mean, it just feels like that was like a different part of their life that they can't connect to anymore. Does that make sense? And so it's the gap between what ought to be, what I even intuitively want, and what actually is being delivered to me in the environment and culture that I live in.
Saying about that is a uniquely disenchanted society feature. Like, I mean, obviously there's all, I guess, yeah, can you speak to, like, is that uniquely a disenchanted culture, or in the enchanted culture, I mean, there, I assume there's still a disconnect in some ways, but I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question, Tommy, because, I mean, I haven't lived in an enchanted culture, so I don't know, right? Because I do think that's a lot of enchanted cultures are, like, more pre-modern for what we would consider. I mean, because I do think the Enlightenment was a very clear formative change from that, like, I believe and now I'm trying to understand everything too. I'm only going to take things that are real according to the metrics that I now live by. And it's more subtle, right? It's more precognitive even than that. It's not necessarily. So that's a good question. I think I'm only trying to speak to, I think this somewhat explains, not excuses, but gives some reference point for where we find ourselves in 21st century Western, at least America. And some of this has anecdotal points for me in ministry. But I think all that has kind of come together and created it's actually like a hard, it's a hard thing to disentangle, right? Like, what of it is the culture and what of it is somebody's specific story? You know, because we can make all these generalizations and those generalizations don't hold true for everybody. And part of this is just born out of what I found on a university campus. I mean, there were people that were actually hungry to learn about Christianity, and some of them had almost no contact with a Christian church prior to coming to the campus. Maybe they were from India, or maybe they were from Tampa, and that was the case. You know, we baptized, praise God, like 13 college-age students, whether they were undergrad or postgrad, in my time there. And it was just like many of them had never had an affiliation with a church before. And I think that's becoming increasingly true. You know, people say we lag, you know, 15 years or so behind England in that kind of secularization, or just, you know, post-Christendom is sometimes a word people say. Like, we're in a post-Christian era where it's not as assumed that people you encounter. And this is less true in Birmingham, but it's becoming more true. Because Birmingham has a kind of metropolitan draw, there's people from other parts of the country and the world moving here. This is going to, I hope, set up Advent and other Christians and churches for, like, really good gospel witness and evangelism. It's not like a forsaken or like horrible situation. It actually helps clarify better. What are people's hungers? What are they longing for? And we'll get more into that next week, actually. I think I'll be in the dean's class for that one next week, for Gil said. So anyway, I'm just trying to lay like a, I think this is where our cultural moment is somewhat. All right. Okay, and I love Babylon Bee captures some of these things really well. You know, when our sensory experience is met with an objective measure of truth and the experience fails or disappoints, it can make belief really unbelievable. And I'm actually going to use this book next week. It's called The Great Dechurching. It just came out last week, so I'm only a little more than halfway through it, but I think it's really helpful because it's a statistical analysis on what's happened, especially in the pandemic, with people in their engagement in church. And there's been a lot of people have disaffiliated. At a rapid rate. In fact, more people have disaffiliated from the church structure in the last, I want to say it's like 20 years, than were converted in the first and second Great Awakenings combined. So let that sink in. That's a pretty big number of people. Oh, yeah. Out of ideas to keep church relevant, a pastor resigns himself to just preaching the gospel. Man, you know, we can feel that one, right? I mean, there's, you know, so many ways we're trying to engage people or make things relevant, right? The guise of relevance. And part of that is because there is a perceived value of authenticity in our culture. People don't want to be not authentic. And yet that is such a trope and a trap. It can actually be kind of laughable. What does it mean to be authentic? According to whom, says who. And oftentimes authenticity is just a projection of how you want to be perceived. It's not actually who you are. That's the irony of it, right? It's just totally, it falls in on itself. It doesn't actually make sense. And so whenever students would say that, I'd be like, well, so what's your authentic self? Tell me. I can't wait, you know? I only want to know the authentic you. And I think I'm still waiting on that one. So I think there's actually a tendency in a lot of churches, especially with declining numbers and dechurching, to move towards like, how do we be relevant? How do we be, you know, you get the, here's how to like 5 steps to make your church, you know, real, real awesome. That relevance can become a new kind of tyranny. You do things without thinking about what the repercussions are. And it's a difficult dance sometimes of how do you meet people where they are, but also bring them along to a place where they need to be. And in some ways, there's some things you can program and there's some things you just can't. You know, you could have Craig get up and like tell everybody, just be more welcoming and be da da. But unless you guys are welcome, and which, by the way, my family has been so welcome. I mean, Advent is so great about welcoming at least a hired, you know, employee. I've gotten really great treatment. I would hope, though, that everybody that comes through the doors here or has an interaction with somebody from Advent just feels such a rich welcome and support and encouragement. And I do think that's just born out. That's authentic. That's real. It's just coming from a real place of generosity. All right. So another thing I want to talk about here in this this cultural moment is this word, this loss of the S word. The biblical concept of sin as some kind of an imprisonment, a stain, a corruption, an oppression, right? That's largely looked down upon by people that are in a more post-Christian, secular age, or disenchanted age. At least personal sin. Corporate sin, very much, you know, right? It's easier to point out, like, all the flaws of our society, and much harder, actually, to grapple with what kind of person I am, especially when it's as easy as, you know, clicking a button and liking or loving or post or reposting the thing that you agree with, right? That's oftentimes the... especially among young people that I worked with over the last 5 years was very much... how they avoided being judged by peers was, oh, I participated in the movement of this hour. And I'm on the right, quote unquote, right side of history on this one. Right. Because there's a real pressure to not be judged, because judgment. And so they're trying to avoid sin. they're trying so hard to avoid it. It's what was it Flannery O'Connor said in Wise Blood about the people in that town. They worked so hard to be good that they avoided Jesus. You know, like, you don't need Jesus if you're good. And that's largely what the project of being human in our culture right now is. It's keep the deflect and keep the judgment away from me. And so the thing that motivates quote unquote goodness often is just simply they're scared to death. And we all are, right, of being exposed for who our real authentic self actually is, which is not necessarily a great person in the eyes of the culture. And so that's where evangelism actually oftentimes feels like this, like, pitting of people against each other. Like, you're just hearing a one-way, you know, condemnation or finger-pointing. It makes people want to bury their head in the sand or just, okay, let me find my happy place. I can't hear that. They're having trouble hearing that they're sinners, which is ironic, right? Because people are often very quick to point out who they think are sinners, but they don't want it done to them, right? It's kind of a one-way street oftentimes. So talking about evangelism, right? At its base, in some ways, we're telling somebody they're wrong about something. And that feels a little prickly and offensive in our culture, especially if you don't know them very well, or if they can point to, hey, on my Instagram or on my Facebook, look, I'm on all the right causes. I'm not that bad of a person, because it's very comparative, right? I'm not some of these wackos on this extreme or that extreme. I'm doing the right thing. So it's hard for people to feel, because judgment's so tied up in social capital and social dynamics. And so I think inherent in that is like the judge not lest you be judged idea. But part of where this comes from, some sociologists say, is that we used to be this guilt innocence culture where you make a mistake and you made a mistake, right? Like, hey, everybody makes mistakes. You know, here's your second chance. You can pull it together. But there are shame honor cultures, and that's more where our Western tradition has been moving, where making a mistake means actually you're the mistake, right? This is where cancel culture comes from. It's very much like there's some things that cross lines that you can't come back from, right? And that's... there's a whole conversation we can have around that, because actually I think it was the evangelical Christians that started cancel culture. But it's full tail. The snake always eats its tail in cancel culture kind of dynamic, because there's always somebody you have to go after. And usually it's because you're avoiding being judged yourself. Oh, the bells are ringing. Does that mean, I guess we're done at this point. Jay, is that right? Well, I'm going to stop there. We'll have to pick up next week. I've got more. I planned for way more material than I had here. So, I know we didn't get into evangelism specific. I was just trying to lay some of the, like, where we're at thoughts, curiosities, clarification. Has what ever been different? The dynamic.
Our relationship. Yeah. World, the flesh, and the devil versus his kingdom.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's wherever in history you start, it's the same dynamic that we choose the world, the flesh, and the devil. And we rebel against God's plan for our life because it's control. We perceive it as controlling because we listen to that lie that's whispering in our ear. We need to do something else.
So. Yeah. Absolutely, David. From the beginning.
Getting awful, but it's always been awful.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're totally right. And that's important to keep in mind is, yeah, there's not this like kids these days kind of thing. It's like, no. This is, we all have kids these days, no matter what day we were in. We were the kids those days. And so, yeah, it just looks different in different settings. And this is, again, more of a U.S.-based. This wouldn't necessarily play out in the same way in other cultures, and I couldn't speak to that, right? I'm just in this one, and this is the one I feel like I have some experience to critique and say, and I'm just trying to explain where some of the challenges and opportunities, that's what I'm trying to set up, is there's actually a lot of opportunity. It's not actually worse or better. It's just a different manifestation of that old sin problem. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
You may speak to this more next week, but what do you do to reach somebody that is in that point between understanding what they've been taught and reckoning with what they're experiencing?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know, just like met a lot of people that are kind of paralyzed in between those two things, and I've never really known how to discuss faith with them.
Man, thank you for that. What's your name?
Reese.
Thanks, Reese. That's really insightful. And I think really sometimes in evangelism, there's kind of no magic. I mean, that's part of what, like, here you go, tagline. You don't have to do any of the other ones on this evangelism series I'm doing. I mean, it's walking with people and not, sometimes the best answer we can go is, I'm not sure, man. All I can do right now with you is look to God and look for help, and maybe there's resources. Because everybody's going to, some things that work for one person isn't necessarily going to work for someone else, right? And some people say they want an explanation, or if I just knew, I mean, that's part of the tease, right? Of if I just had some kind of information and put it into the system and ran it through, it would work. And maybe it's because I'm married to a therapist, but I just think there's a lot to discover in our stories about how we came to be and why those gaps exist between our experience and our expectation, and encountering that. So Reese, I think part of it is just being in a flesh and blood relationship with somebody and just expressing care and never walking away from that actually has a lot of value in evangelism. Because after all, in evangelism, it's God's work, not ours. It's God's promise, not our work. You know, he promises that that will happen. We just get to, man, how exciting that we get to participate with him, that he would use really messed up vessels to bring his grace into others' lives. Because none of us would be here if somebody hadn't done some evangelism. So God's used all kinds of people in our lives. And he wants to use you too. And that's good news. So let me, I was going to close with another collect from our morning prayer. A lot of our collects do have missional impulse, and I love that. So let's pray. That's evening prayer. Sorry, I was looking in morning prayer. Hold your prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, who didst stretch out thine arms of love on the hard wood of the cross, that everyone might come within reach of thy saving embrace, so clothe us in thy Spirit, that we, reaching forth our hands in love, may bring those who do not know thee to the knowledge and love of thee, for the honor of thy name. Amen. Thanks, y'all.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.